A warning, this episode features detailed discussions of sexual harassment and assault. In 2017, the Me Too movement brought to light accusations of sexual abuse and misconduct against powerful people in entertainment. Most of the women whose allegations received detailed media consideration were white, and so were most of the men they accused. But late that year, a number of women, several of them Black women, alleged sexual assault and other misconduct by hip-hop mogul Russell Simmons. Simmons is the enormously powerful man behind Def Jam. The new HBO Max documentary On the Record tells the stories of some of Russell Simmons' accusers and includes interviews with a lot of Black women about specific worries and conflicted feelings that arise when Black women raise allegations against Black men. I'm Linda Holmes. We're talking about On the Record on this episode of Pop Culture Happy Hour from NPR, so don't go away.
This message comes from NPR sponsor Bright Cellars, the personalized wine subscription company that matches you to wines based on your tastes. You take a 30-second quiz, and their algorithm matches you to wines you'll like. Bright Cellars is passionate about educating people on wine, which is why every package comes with wine education cards that tell you more about the wines in your box, like the flavor profile, what to pair it with, and where it's from. Visit brightcellars.com/pop, and you'll receive 50% off your first six-bottle box.
Welcome back. Joining us is Brittany Luce, who is co-host and co-executive producer of The Nod, now on Quibi. Welcome back, Brittany.
Thank you for having me. It's good to be back.
Of course. Also with us is Taylor Crumpton. Taylor writes about music, pop culture, and politics. Her work has appeared in a number of places, including Pitchfork, Nylon, and Marie Claire. Welcome, Taylor.
Hey, I'm so happy to be here.
So before we get into On the Record, some basics about the allegations against Russell Simmons. The film says 20 women have accused him of sexual misconduct or assault. The incidents women have described allegedly occurred between the early 1980s and the mid-2010s. Simmons denies all the allegations. He says every sexual encounter he's ever had has been consensual. As for the film, On the Record premiered on HBO Max a few weeks ago. It's directed by Kirby Dick and Amy Ziering, who also worked on The Invisible War, a documentary about sexual assault in the military, and The Hunting Ground, which is about sexual assault on college campuses. The film was originally set to air on Apple TV Plus with Oprah Winfrey attached as executive producer. Winfrey withdrew as EP and Apple TV Plus dropped the film. Winfrey said she had creative differences with the directors. She says that while she believes the film's primary subject, Drew Dixon, she also thinks there are inconsistencies in Dixon's story that the film didn't address. Russell Simmons had pressured Winfrey to step away from the project. Drew Dixon says Simmons raped her in 1995 when she was an A&R executive at Def Jam Records. She says Simmons lured her into his apartment to listen to a new demo.
He just grabbed me. And he just threw me in the bed. I mean, wrestled me to the bed and pins me down. And I'm fighting. And I'm saying no. He's telling me to stop fighting in a very cold, menacing, detached voice that I'd never, ever heard from him before.
The film includes allegations from other women. It also details Dixon's experience with Arista Records executive L.A. Reid, who she says derailed her career a second time when she rejected advances from him after she left Def Jam. Both Simmons and Reid declined to be interviewed for the film and both deny all allegations against them. As of now, neither has been criminally charged. With all that introduction, Brittany, let me start with you. We've spent a lot of time, I feel like, listening to stories like this. There have been a couple of other documentaries about famous people, famous men with similar allegations against them or other allegations against them. What did you take away from this film that felt specifically significant?
There are a couple major things. The first one being that this is, like, I think, hip hop's first major Me Too moment. There was a situation with Dr. Luke and Kesha. That was a pretty big music story, but this is one of the first, like, non-R. Kelly Black music, Me Too stories that has gotten this level of attention. And even in R. Kelly's case, Jim DeRogatis in Chicago was doing decades of reporting on R. Kelly. Even still, I'd say only within the 5 years has stories about R. Kelly's abuse have been able to sort of get, I think, the attention and coverage that they really deserve. It also was the first moment that I saw a lot of Black women coming forward. That was something that really grabbed my attention. I remember when Me Too came out with a lot of the like actresses, but you know, as you mentioned, many of them were white and many of the men that they accused were white. But the music industry is just an entirely different animal altogether. But yeah, this story specifically focusing on assault between a Black man in the music industry and many Black women. The other thing I think is like the music industry is in some ways, I think, less professionalized than Hollywood. Hollywood operates with a lot of unions. You could be a member of SAG or AFTRA. There's Directors Guild, Producers Guild. There are so many different professional organizations, you know, how well their rules are enforced are obviously varying. But with music, you also don't have those types of professional organizations that can provide guidelines or systems of accountability for people who misbehave. Music is kind of like this untouched industry, I think. These are stories of assault between a Black man and many Black women who were largely missing, I think, from Hollywood's Me Too moment. With the exception of a couple cases, Lupita Nyong'o comes to mind. I felt like I didn't see very many Black actresses coming forward, you know, with stories like that about men like Harvey Weinstein. But when that first story, I think it was December 2017, when that first New York Times story came out that featured Drew Dixon, actually, it got my attention. It definitely felt different.
Taylor, you write about music a lot. What do you think makes this film and these allegations and stories different from other kind of parts of Me Too?
So what makes On the Record so particular, when we're talking about the music industry and specifically about hip hop, right, we have to think about the way in which Russell Simmons is the face of hip hop and, in my personal opinion, the prophet of hip hop to the world, right? Hip hop, unlike some of the genres mentioned in the film, such as rock and pop, is distinctly and universally known as a Black genre of music, right? It's one of the few cultural productions that the Black community still has a stronghold over. And as we know, looking at the way in which cisgender Black women operate in the community, they very much are the laborers, the support network, the foundation. And those kind of socialized notions are reflected in this film when so many of the Black women survivors said, you know, I love the culture. I loved Russell. I loved so much of what he represented and what he brought that I was willing to put my needs aside in order for the culture to survive and progress. And that's something that we're seeing reflected in so many of these movements, whether it's Me Too or what's currently going on with all of the organizing efforts, is a lot of the people on the front line are the Black femmes who show up for Black women, who show up for Black men, who show up for Black members of the LGBTQ community. But as we've seen, they may be the ones on the front lines, but their lives are the ones kind of most negatively impacted when we're talking about violence. So in particular, in this story, we're seeing countless Black women, from Drew Dixon being an A&R, from Black models, Black actresses, Black people who contributed so much to the culture, but had to wait decades for their stories to be told, even though all the survivors kind of said within the film, we know that our voices are not going to be uplifted in the way compared to our white female counterparts when Me Too came out.
Yeah. One of the things that really struck me was that the women in the film were talking about two things that are related but somewhat different, which is that within the music industry, they felt like Russell Simmons was a leader in the culture, but also more general kind of reluctance on the part of Black women to make accusations against Black men that might play into stereotypes about Black men as predatory or violent, or might subject them to a justice system that's often incredibly unjust and racist. Brittany, do you think, am I reading that right, do you think?
Yeah, I mean, I think that the film took a lot of time to lay that out. Also, just speaking from like experience from my own personal life, whether the situation had been mine, a family member, or a friend, there is this idea that I think is perpetuated also in like the hip hop community that we, quote unquote, Black people are under attack enough as it is. There is no need to, you know, start pointing fingers and placing blame. And as you mentioned, Linda, possibly, you know, opening up members of our community, namely in this sense, you know, cisgender Black men, opening them up to further violence. You know, I also have been thinking a lot about, to Taylor's point, how Russell Simmons was somebody who introduced hip hop to the world. The world didn't necessarily welcome hip hop with open arms. He had to do, I think, for mainstream audiences and also, you know, a lot of people in business, a lot of cultural translating, trying to say that, you know, hip hop was for everybody in a way. I think that like for so long, like hip hop has gotten an undue amount of blame for, you know, having a uniquely misogynistic culture, which is something the film also gets into that, you know, also exists in other genres of music because we live in a misogynistic society on a misogynistic planet, really. Hip hop, I think, has often borne the brunt of that type of critique. And I also think that a lot of these women, because they were so, you know, vital to the hip hop community, they also took, I think, some of that into account. They wanted the culture to survive. And so they didn't want to open up, you know, a lot of the men who were pushing the culture forward, quote unquote, the culture forward, to be any more maligned in mainstream culture than they already were. So I think it was like about protecting Black men, yes, but something else I picked up from the film was that they were also trying to maintain and uplift the reputation of this culture that they helped create and that they loved so much.
Yeah, because you do hear, you know, Drew Dixon say at one point, it was one of, to me, the most sort of poignant moments in the film is when she kind of says, I wanted him to be a hero too, because he had been successful and because he had managed to do so much for so many artists. Taylor, what are you thinking?
I think when we have these conversations about like power dynamics in relation to gender and hip hop, we have to think about hip hop on a theoretical level, right? The genre was in the beginning very radical and being counterculture for a lot of urban communities. Hip hop was the only way in which they could speak about the discriminatory experiences in their neighborhoods. It really became, as I kind of classify, Black America's songbook. We were able to kind of have an uncensored form of communication and share that with other communities, right? I think a lot about the era of gangster rap where people in Compton were talking about their experiences with police brutality, which was reflected in the Bronx. But when we're having these conversations and you see Russell kind of capitalizing on this early emergent genre that he loved and taking it mainstream, we have to understand what gets lost when something that is counterculture then becomes the culture, and what does that emulate, right? What happens when something becomes undergrounded and mainstream? Because right now, hip-hop is the world's most popular genre, so I think this documentary has the potential to actually evolve and push the culture forward, because what happens right now in a year where women rappers are dominating the hip-hop, the pop, top 40 in Billboard charts, but we have these elders sharing their stories about how their livelihoods were negatively impacted because they loved hip-hop so much. So I think this documentary can really, if used correctly, can be a changing in the tides of how we move forward in 2020 and the decades to come. I mean, the genre is going to turn 50 pretty soon. So what happens if we're finally able to address these gender power dynamics? But that also shouldn't have to be the responsibility of Black women to move the culture forward. Now is the time for the men who we've seen still maintain close proximity to Russell or to Def Jam to really take a moment to sit down and evaluate, in what ways have I also abused women? In what way have I also pushed women out of hip hop right now when we're asking for women in hip hop? We're asking for queer people in hip hop to come. But as we've seen, if there's been decades of gendered violence in the genre, then of course we're not going to see that reflected in the artist and in the management.
Yeah, you know, one of the things that I thought was so interesting that I appreciated in the film is they take a moment sort of mostly toward the end to talk about the fact that Drew Dixon was this extremely talented young A&R executive. And she, after having these experiences at Def Jam and then these experiences with L.A. Reid that she talks about, she essentially just went off and did other things. She kind of left behind what she loved. She says in the film she didn't listen to the music that she made for a very long time. And there's some talk in the film about what work is lost. And I'm always a little bit nervous about reframing how we should feel about someone else's traumatic experiences in terms of what they cost everyone else, you know, what it costs society. But I did think that it was interesting, particularly because the film starts off, one of the first things you hear her say is that she had this very close relationship with Biggie Smalls. And she says, I wonder whether anything would have been different if he had lived, essentially. Mm-hmm. The whole film is this almost like a what if, like what would she be doing now if this had not interrupted the career that she was having?
Thinking about what was lost, both for the women in the film and also for us and also for mm-hmm. hip hop culture and Black culture at large. You know, thinking about what was lost for all of these women, as Taylor mentioned, who are at the top of the charts right now. How many more women would be at the top of the charts? How much more money would those women make? Would Nicki Minaj have ever had to make the pickle juice speech if Drew Dixon, you know what I mean? Or Sherry Cher from the Mercedes Ladies, you know, all the stories affected me, but Sherry Cher's story does stand out to me because she wasn't even able to get in the room. Sherry Cher was one of the women from the film who started the first all-female hip-hop group called the Mercedes Ladies coming out of the Bronx. In the early 80s, you know, she says that Russell Simmons assaulted her when she was really seeking to start a professional relationship with him to get the Mercedes Ladies, you know, out there in the world. And that is so heartbreaking to me to think about how talented, how confident, how smart you have to be to even be in the early 80s to know, okay, Russell Simmons is the guy I need to get in front of, to actually get there in front of him and shoot your shot. That takes so much gumption as a young woman. And according to her, he assaulted her, and that really ended her desire to want to continue forward with music. She instead later became an author. I just can't help but think about, you know, Sherry Cher is the name of a woman that we know. There are so many other names of women that we don't, that we've never even heard because they didn't even get the opportunity to, nor, or maybe they didn't feel, maybe they're too afraid to share their story. Maybe for good reason. It's hard to watch the film without coming away thinking that obviously that these women were robbed, but also that our culture was robbed, and that like one of the major building blocks of hip hop, almost like it wasn't really there. Like hip hop is missing a foundational element that, you know, I think to Taylor's point, keeps it from growing. We're 50 years in, and this is one of the first major times that we're having a conversation about gendered violence in hip hop this large. Yeah, it's hard not to, as you say, Linda, not to center yourself and think like, man, what did I miss out on? But I think it's really, in a way, respectful of these women's creativity and legacies to imagine what they could have done. Mm-hmm. The whole film feels like this incredible loss that I'm still wrapping my head around.
Yeah, Brittany, I think to kind of highlight both you and Linda's points, when we look at the history of hip hop, right, there's so many countless books. There's become now academic fields of study about the genre. Yet those foundational texts, when we think about, we see this absence of women pioneers that aren't MC Light, that aren't Queen Latifah, that aren't the ones that have been able to cross into mainstream consciousness and maintain their positionality in pop culture, whether that's through Queen Latifah's kind of transition into acting and more production and film, whether it's MC Light being a woman with acting experience for over 20 years. We look back at the beginnings of the Boogie Down, the early Bronx, and if you wouldn't have this documentary, if you wouldn't be someone who is a hip-hop journalist or really dedicates time into learning the history of the beat, you would assume that hip-hop only has four fathers, that it really doesn't have four mothers, or that the four mothers that came drew inspiration from the four fathers, right? So we kind of are in this era now where as Gen Z enters into the field and millennials are really becoming the gatekeepers of the field, if you don't grow up with that knowledge, we just indirectly assume that this is a very male genre. Mm-hmm. And even in the foundations of hip hop freestyling. We've heard from every woman rapper how they had to work twice as hard just to be respected, just to even get probably in the room with Russell, right? Their group was known throughout the South Bronx, right? They had regional acclaim. But because of that act of gendered violence, that regional acclaim never materialized into the mainstream success they deserve. What would hip hop look like if we had an all-female rap group from New York, the birthplace of hip hop, on Billboard in 1988 or 1989? And I think we can have this imaginative future, and I hate that it has to also be centered in this absence and this gap, because as we saw with the two beautiful Black women who did The Show Must Be Paused, you know, in solidarity mm-hmm. with all the actions in the music industry, that action was done by Black women in music, urban music, hip hop, if we would like to call it, to really challenge the industry about its anti-Blackness and its racism. But as we see, it's still Black femmes pushing the industry forward. It's still Black femmes pushing hip hop to take accountability for its actions. But I just wish that we were able to have these conversations in the 80s, but I know that so many Black women had to sacrifice their livelihoods just for those women to be able to put that action and promise. And as we see now, urban is being removed from a lot of the recording industry's companies. Mm-hmm. So I'm wondering to see the solidarity and the unification that can come from this moment to really make sure that we're having a more hospitable environment for Black women who don't feel like they have to diminish themselves or dehumanize their experiences just to give back to this culture.
Yeah. On the Record, available on HBO Max. Let us know what you think. Find us on Facebook at facebook.com/PCHH. Tweet us at PCHH. That was usually the point in the show where we talk about what's making us happy this week, but we thought we'd do something a little bit different. Brittany and Taylor are going to give us a signal boost for some places to find great music in hip hop by women. Take it away, Brittany.
So I'm going to talk about Bree Runway. She is incredible. She sings, she raps. Her aesthetics are unbelievable. She has this uncanny energy that, like, I just can't even. She's just, everything about her is incredible. She is a pop star. She's a hip hop star. But she also, like, her videos are so thrilling and exciting and, like, story-based in this way that I honestly don't feel like I've seen in, like, a decade. Missy Elliott and Busta Rhymes come to mind sort of when I think about, like, just like the vividness of the visuals that Bree Runway does. You can watch her videos on loop, even with the sound off, for like an hour and a half, and it's going to be the best hour and a half that you have this week. So I definitely want to highly recommend Bree Runway. Also, she and Young Baby Tate had a song that came out maybe a month or two ago called Damn Daniel. Also had an amazing video. I'm like, I don't know how these girls did this while we're all like locked up in quarantine, but they did it. Like, Bree Runway, her mind. I highly, highly, highly recommend.
Yeah, let's hear a little bit of Bree Runway, Damn Daniel. All right. Thank you very much, Brittany Luce. Taylor, what do you want to recommend?
Yeah, I'm recommending The Gumbo. It is a independent run hip hop platform for Black women by Black women. What they are very much highlighting is that hip hop journalism has been traditionally male. And this is one of the few opportunities in the digital space that Black and Latinx women, because we have to be mindful of the Afro-Latinx origins of hip hop, are able to really do beautiful archival work, whether it's highlighting Mia X, who is the first lady of No Limit Records and really set the standard for rappers like Trina and Meg Thee Stallion can come from the Southern Black hip hop tradition, as well as highlighting a lot of new artists like maybe Young Baby Tate was on there. They have a lot of great independent Black woman rappers who can't get an XL byline or a pitchfork, but they have The Gumbo in there. And they recently just raised enough money to stay open. So if you really can, please support, you know, Black women hip hop journalism.
Thank you so much, Taylor. I really appreciate that. I'm very grateful to both of you for being here. That does bring us to the end of our show. You can find all of us on Twitter. I'm at Linda Holmes. Taylor is at Taylor Crumpton. Brittany is at BM Luce. That's L-U-S-E. Our producer, Jessica Reedy, is at Jessica_Reedy. Our producer, Mike Katziff, is at Mike Katziff, K-A-T-Z-I-F. Again, thank you both so much for being here to talk about this.
Thank you for having me.
Thank you.
And thanks so much to Sydney Madden at NPR Music, who brought us this idea, helped pull this panel together. And thanks for listening to Pop Culture Happy Hour from NPR. If you have a second, subscribe to our newsletter. It's at npr.org/popculturenewsletter. We will see you all right back here next week.
Hey, y'all, I'm Sam Sanders, host of It's Been a Minute. There is a lot going on in the world. So on my show, my guest and I make sense of the news and culture through conversation. It feels like we're living in three movies at once.
That's a good way to put it.
It feels like a Mike Judge movie. It feels like a Spike Lee movie. And it feels like a Michael Bay movie. Like
Every Tuesday and Friday, listen and subscribe now to It's Been a Minute from NPR.